Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Driven with Andy J on Talk Radio in association with Paramex Digital. You dream it, we bring it to life. Find out more at drivenchat.com.
Hey, welcome to Driven here on Talk Radio with me, Andy J. This is the show that talks to celebrities and achievers about what drives them. And we have three very special celebrity guests for you today. First up, we have a man who is, well, probably one of Hollywood's brightest shining stars from films like X-Men Apocalypse and Bohemian Rhapsody, the most excellent Ben Hardy. He's one of the guests. Then we have a man who is one of the greatest and most successful male supermodels of all time. He's a true Brit. Mr. David Gandy. And then finally, a judge who, well, basically everybody loves because everybody watches Strictly Come Dancing. Craig Revel Horwood completes my hat trick of chatting celebrity heroes today here on Driven.
Driven with Andy J on Talk Radio in association with Paramex Digital. You dream it, we bring it to life. Find out more at drivenchat.com.
My first guest this week you'll know is the sixth Peter Beale in EastEnders before starring in films including X-Men Apocalypse and Bohemian Rhapsody, where he played Roger Taylor in the Queen biopic. But he's here today to talk about his latest role in the new film Pixie, where he plays the character of Frank. Ben, welcome to Driven. Now let's start by talking about Frank. How would you describe him?
So Frank's the kind of guy that was a sports star at school, did well with the ladies, but those were his glory days. And now he's in his mid-20s and he's looking back on that wonderful time where he thought maybe he was going to play football in the Premier League for Man United. It never quite happened. And now he's in his mid-20s realising that everything he thought he was going to achieve has just slowly not happened. And so he's desperate to get out of Sligo, the small town that he's from, and go on an adventure of some kind, and considers himself to be a bit of a wild man. So when he stumbles upon a big old bag of drugs, he sees it as a perfect way to make some cash and get out of there.
But it's such an entertaining film, Ben. I mean, of course, you know, your character Frank, he's one of the lead roles. He falls for the heroine, Pixie, of course, who the film is named after, accidentally realises that he's in the middle of this crazy kind of drug swindle that, to my great joy, involves deadly gangster priests. Did you know that when the script hit, when you were first handed the script for this, did you have any inkling about the gangster priests? Did anyone tell you beforehand, or did, when you got to that point in the script, did you just go, oh my, this is taking a twist?
No one told me beforehand. No, it was definitely quite the shock. I think it adds to the absurdity of the whole thing and to the comedy of the whole thing. And it's all tongue-in-cheek. It's not, you know, making a statement about priests or anything, but it's, definitely, but I still wasn't prepared to be on set and see men in priests holding 9mm. That's quite an interesting image to see up close.
It's just glorious. You've got to tell me this, Ben, because, you know, I mean, like you, I've been fortunate to come into sort of contact with some really cool looking things that you're not allowed to have your mobile phone around for. When you saw Alec Baldwin decked out as a priest holding a Glock, did you just think, now I could Instagram the heck out of that?
You know, I'm not much of an Instagrammer. You're right, though. I'm sure that would have got some likes. I'm the kind of guy, I don't take enough photos, really. So it doesn't cross my mind. I always, you know, take it in through my eyes first rather than take a photo of it. But you're right, it would have done.
I think it would have been
quite a sensation to get there first and put it out on the internet.
I think it probably speaks more to your professionalism that you didn't naturally think, I need to get a photo of this on my phone, rather than, you know, me who just wants to snap everything and then get told off. So, you know, you win on that one. You're all good. But I got to say, I mean, you've worked with some legends, but Alec Baldwin, I'd love to meet him. It must have been pretty darn cool. I know you probably don't get fazed by these things anymore, but nonetheless, he's an icon, isn't he?
Absolutely, and I was thrilled to be working with him. And he's so professional, just came in and did his business, brought his own ideas, and really kind of elevated the whole thing. Yeah, like you say, I grew up with Glengarry Glen Ross, is like one of my favourite movies, and a lot of his films, you know, there's so many great films. There's a reason that he's at the top, and it's because he's always at the top of his game, and he brought that to this film as well. And so it was great to watch him and try and learn from them, and to see someone who's such an experienced pro still be so passionate and so dedicated.
Yeah, no, he's an absolute dude. And I must say, without sort of blowing smoke, you know, in the wrong directions, Ben, you're very, very good. I mean, I've watched everything you've done, of course. We need to talk about Bohemian Rhapsody. We need to talk about X-Men Apocalypse. But, you know, focusing on Pixie, because it's out on the 23rd. And I really do want to encourage people, if they feel safe and comfortable going to the cinemas, and I've done it, it's a, you know, the environment that I was in was completely safe and brilliant. And if they feel like they should be going to the cinema, this is such a good movie to go to. And you're very, very strong in it. You find that balance of kind of panic-stricken fear yet sort of trying to be cool to impress the girl thing just right, you know, the audience absolutely like you because of your innocence.
Thank you very much. Well, I can say for that one. That's very kind of you to say.
Well, I guess what I'm trying to say, Ben, is obviously you're very, very good in what is a very watchable, very entertaining film. And it's just the sort of tonic. You know, we're in a time of life right now. 2020 has been like this for everyone, where the world is weird. It's strange. It's uncomfortable. It's ever changing. The rules seem to be constantly moving in different directions. And sometimes we just need a happy distraction. And Pixie feels like that.
I love going to the cinema. I'm at the cinema myself. So, you know, for that period where cinemas, A, were closed was difficult. Then when they reopened, then there was a lot of things being shown again from previous years. You know, that's not quite the same. So it'd be nice to have some new material out of cinema. Obviously, it's up to the individual if they're comfortable to go to the cinema. You know, that's something that I'm still comfortable doing, but obviously an individual decision based upon the viewer.
Ben, let's talk about your fast track to superstar, because, you know, you are quite the shooting star, aren't you? I mean, you started out actually at the theatre, and we'll go back to that in a moment. But, you know, in terms of the general public in the UK, our perception of you initially was from EastEnders, and then before you know it, you're in X-Men Apocalypse, and then you're Roger Taylor in Bohemian Rhapsody and Mary Shelley. I mean, it's a pretty cool life right now, isn't it?
You're great, by the way. You're giving me a massive ego boost. Thanks for that. So, yeah, I don't know about superstardom, but I am very thankful to be to have worked on the projects that I've worked on. Yeah, I mean, I got into this racket thinking if I did theatre all my life, I'd be happy. Maybe I still would be, but obviously there's no theatre up and running at the minute, not really. But yeah, so I'm very, 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 very lucky and very fortunate, and I've worked hard as well. But yeah, very thankful to have got the roles that I've got, and I get to keep exploring new characters and new projects and work with great creatives, and that will be the aim. That's the hope, worked on those things that you aforementioned.
From the outside looking in, Ben, you know, I can only see huge things ahead for you. And I think part of the reason for that is, you know, you've got the looks, you've clearly got the talent. You know, you're a very, very capable actor who's commanded a number of different emotions very easily on screen, which is a huge thing to be able to do. But you've also got something which I think sets you apart, which is, quite frankly, balls of steel. And you'll kind of hear where I'm going. I don't mean this to be a natural kind of connection, but I want to take you back to when you starred in The Judas Kiss at the theatre, David Hare's play, and you'll know where I'm going now. Full frontal nudity move.
Yeah.
That was a brave move.
Did you see it?
I didn't.
No, just out of curiosity. You know, that was, kind of like balls of steel. That was just young actor out of drama school to work, really. I think now I've done it, I would do it again. I was definitely very trepidatious about doing that. But, you know, it served the tech. I got over my own fears about exposing my manhood. But it was actually quite liberating. And I ended up, by the end of the 8-month run, or maybe about a month into it, really, I felt some sense of power. And just so my character in the play would stand centre stage and expose himself, unwrap a sheet from around his waist. So it was quite liberating in a way to expose myself to the whole auditorium. It felt quite powerful in some kind of way. So yeah, I was enjoying it. I'm not going to join a nudist colony anytime soon, but I had a good time with that play for sure.
It's a big one to tick off the CV. It's interesting you say you would do it again, because now, I mean, like you said, then you were starting out. Now you're very, very well known. I mean, there'd be queues around the block. The ladies would be queuing up, and they wouldn't really care what the play was, would they? You know, there'd be.
I don't know about that. I wouldn't want them to come for the wrong reason. But yeah.
I'm going to carry on this balls of steel analogy. I didn't mean it to mean to your private parts, but I also mean because you have this attitude where you just say yes to things. For example, playing the drums, Roger Taylor, wasn't something you could do prior to landing the role in the film, but you told them you could, and then you got yourself local lessons. There's some stones carrying on with that, man. Well done.
Thanks, mate. Yeah, thank you. Yeah, I mean, well, it's the old acting trope, isn't it? You know, just so you can do it and then figure it out later. It was definitely a real shock because I then bought a drum kit as well, so I could have wasted the money on that as well. And I've taken other shots like that before in the past that haven't worked out. But as an actor, sometimes, you know, with jobbing actor where you're hunting for work, there's a lot that is out of your control. But if you can do what's within your control and within your control, try and get a part, at least you can walk away from it and say, well, I did everything I could. That's my philosophy.
And you can see Ben in Pixie on your first cinema visit out from the 23rd of October. And what better film to start your visits again with? Now, after the break, I'm joined by Strictly Judge Craig Revel-Horwood.
Driven with Andy J.
It's Driven here on Talk Radio, the show that talks to celebrities and achievers about what drives them. And I'm so delighted to be able to introduce my next guest. He is a critically acclaimed dancer, director, choreographer and artist. And he is, of course, one of the most familiar faces on British TV, thanks to Strictly Come Dancing. I'm elated to be able to welcome to the show Mr. Craig Revel-Horwood. How are you doing, Craig?
Oh, thank you. That was a wonderful introduction. Thank you. Who wrote that for?
It's all true. It's 100%
true. It's all
true.
It's all true.
I love it. I mean, you have achieved so much, Craig, and I've got so many things I'd like to talk to you about. But we have to start off with what is... I mean, I'm sure loads of the public know about this, but you are also an author and now a novelist, because we're aware of obviously your biographies and so on. But now you've written... A wonderful novel, which I've started reading. I'm well into it. It's a page turner. It's funny. It's romantic. It's charming. But it also feels to me to be quite autobiographical. If I can put my teeth back in.
Yes. Well, it sort of is, because it's based on my life when I lived in Camden Town in 1994, and I was living in a house share with six other people, and I decided I was at a crossroads in my life at that time, where my dance career at the age of 30 was coming to an end, and I had to decide what to do. And of course, I had no money. I had to make a decision about hanging up my dance shoes and whether I go into direction and choreography and whether or not I was even good at that. And I decided to go for it. So it's at that point where I was at a crossroads. And of course, I was living with all of these other people with literally no money. So it was quite, quite difficult. You know, we had to be in a house share because of money problems, you know. And for me, that created a London family for me, because we're all people, you know, that come from all different walks of life together to try and make it in the city, you know, to try and become something. It's people that are between their 20s and 30s, all wanting something from life and searching for it. And I was living with artists, designers, that sort of, you know, those type of people. And they were all quite sort of mad, really, and arty-farty types, you know. So it was quite amazing. And the stories that came out of it, I could not put into my autobiographies, really, and of which I've written three. So I thought, how can I express all of these wonderful characters and stories? And I thought, fiction, darling, because then, you know, because then you can actually, you can change the names, you can say anything you like.
I absolutely love it. It's called Dances and Dreams on Diamond Street, and it really resonates with me. I mean, it reminded me of when I left university. I did a theatre and arts degree, and just like you, kind of dived into this crazy big old world of London, and you start living with randoms who have kind of similar goals and similar dreams, and you start socializing in the arts and the Phoenix and all these cool little places. And
that's true, yeah, completely. And it's all about, you know, Camden Town at that time, and I thought it was a really good time to write it, only because that's when fax machines were first available, you know. I remember we were all super excited. And when we first got the internet, they dial up, you know, ding, 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 you know, that thing that a lot of people don't know about anymore. But it was amazing, really, you know. But I totally loved that period of time. Of course, there were trials, there were tribulations, and there were fights and there were arguments. But then, you know, all of us together became one big family, which is brilliant and very sort of resonates with today, when people, of course, you know, are in similar situations, but in lockdown. So people are working from home. So now you're having to live with your other flatmates, you know, in house shares. You're stuck with them because everyone is in their bedrooms working from home. So that doesn't normally happen. So that puts, you know, an added pressure, I think, on relationships. And it is about that, you know, and it is a romantic comedy. And I didn't want it to be doom and gloom and all, oh, it's nasty living with other people. It's not about that at all. You know, it's quite an amusing look at life back then, and also my life. But there's a lead character in it who is the patriarch, really, of the house, and his name is Danny Hall. And I based myself on that particular character all the way through. So there's one sort of clear link, you know, that links everybody together. And here's a character that sort of helps people out, young dancers that are coming into the house, they're auditioning for the first time in the West End or for movies and stuff like that.
Yeah.
There's another character in there that wasn't accepted in the countryside because he wanted to dress like Boy George and wanted to change his name to Jewel, you know. And it's about him getting through that. And he's very, very young, you know, someone at 18, impressionable, really trying to, you know, find his way in the world. So it is about those type of people. And also a much older character, Lil, you know, who ends up being the mother type figure within the story. So it's been fantastic fun to write. And the beauty is you can go to town on it, can't you? Because
absolutely. It's
fiction. I love that.
Well, let me ask you, because of course the character that you sort of reference that is based loosely on yourself, in inverted commas, you call him Danny. And of course he's a former Cats dancer. He won an award for the best dancer in the West End, etc. Lots of these similarities here. So how did you choose what isn't your character but could be based on your name? How did you decide, right, if I would, because it's a bit like thinking, who would you play with yourself in the movie? You know, who would be the actor that would play you?
Well, I made sure he was hot, fit, young, and amazing. Everything I'm not.
Oh, come on.
No, it's only because there's such a journey, I think, with that character because of the crossroads that he's at. And I think, you know, other people looking up to him and him learning from the older people within the house as well, and also understanding other people's jobs. You know, I put a nurse in there because they have to work shift work a lot.
A male nurse, which was controversial then.
You know. Yeah, and people forget that. You know, people from the theatre are coming home after working in the theatre at 11 o'clock at night, and that's when they start partying. But of course, that's when this poor character needs to sleep. So there are all of these, you know, complications, and people that have, you know, left surprises after being kicked out of the house. You know, I mean, this all happened, really. But I've just put them into different sort of guises, really, and tried to make it light but amusing and heartwarming, you know. And I think that is the point, isn't it? We don't want to be reading about doom and gloom at this point. I think just to be able to associate with the characters is really, really important.
Oh, it's a very easy
read. Resonate with me, and they'll resonate with a lot of people, and particularly in this time of lockdown and, you know, uncertainty. I think it's really important to give people something to read that they can follow and want to hear more about.
Yes, absolutely. It's a very easy read. It's a very friendly read, and I've smiled throughout every page that I've read so far, and I'm quite deep into the book now, and I'm already thinking, I don't know how this is going to end, but I hope there's a sequel. Are you going to keep going? Because these characters are lovely.
Yeah.
You sort of want to keep learning about them.
Well, even I want to know what happens to Danny.
Does it involve a big TV show?
As soon as we sort of finished it, as soon as I, you know, you put a full stop at the end of it and say, okay, that's where we're taking the characters in this particular 6-month period, you know, there's a long ways to go. So it would be really great, you know, to explore the characters a little bit more, because Danny, in the end, thinks he may have found love, you know, but we don't know yet. So it's one of those. There's like really lovely twists and turns in it, and a big surprise at the end, which people won't see coming, which is great. But obviously, I don't want to tell anyone about that until they read it, you know. But really good fun, and what a pleasure, you know. And I can basing it on, you know, what a dancer goes through in life is quite interesting, because I think people forget how physical dance is and how you are exhausted and your body aches, I mean, every single day. So it's putting up with that, as well as the going from audition and not getting the part and trying to understand and comprehend why, you know, and the struggle, of course, of having to pay the rent, of trying to get to the top, of the competition, you know, and how competitive the West End was at the time, with major shows being out, you know, of course, at that particular time when Cameron McIntosh had huge shows like Les Mis, Miss Saigon, Ma Tanguay. You know, there's some just incredible musicals that were happening at the time. So a lot of work for people, but still the competition was fierce. So it's their battle and struggle of, you know, everything that I literally went through in my life. Before, of course, the advent of Strictly came along.
Yes, yes, exactly. Well, we have to talk about Strictly, but you've mentioned Cameron McIntosh and the sort of dominance of the West End that he had at the time. If you don't mind me saying, you were very involved as well. And also, you, I mean, you were a huge part of this and you locked horns with him, didn't you, if I remember rightly?
Yeah, we did. That was only, I'd worked for Cameron for 8 years as a theatre director, sort of an assistant, you know, to him, where when the original team, creative team, would fly back to America or wherever they're from, I would then take over the show and then maintain it, you know, for many, many years. And I was on Ma Tanguay in that way, Miss Saigon that way, after being in it. I'd put on a show called Crazy For You as well. And that's how I developed myself as a director. Yeah, when we did lock horns, you know, to finally where I wanted a credit, to be honest, just for a show that I was doing, you know, where I wanted to be called co-choreographer. And of course, that didn't work out and that went to someone else. So then I was basically thrown out the double doors and told to stand on my own 2 feet, which was the best thing that ever happened to me. And I can only thank Cameron, you know, for his insight and wisdom. I mean, at the time you think, oh, you know, it's devastating. What am I going to do? How am I going to survive? I couldn't afford my mobile phone. I had to give that up, you know, and I was just thinking, this is crazy. And I went from a really good wage to absolutely nothing. And it was devastating, but it forced me to actually get out there in amongst it all and become a choreographer myself in my own right. And that's what I did. You know, I started at the Watermill Theatre doing shows there. And of course at Chichester Festival Theatre. That's when I first had my first break really with a show called Pal Joey, and that received really great reviews. And from that moment on, the producers, you know, independent producers, were asking me to choreograph and direct their shows. So that's how that occurred, and that's the way to do it, I think. You know, I don't think you just fly in at the top level. I think you've got to learn as you go through in life, and I think it's really important to fail in order to understand failure to become successful. You know, I think that in itself is important, and not to fear failure, but to actually embrace it and think, okay, I may have failed there, but that has taught me to do it this way, yes, or, you know, pushed me forward and pushed me on to bigger and better things. And so I'm never scared of failure. In fact, I embrace it. And I think it's really important to have that outlook in life.
It's so refreshing to hear you say that, Craig, because, you know, this show is about what drives people, what gets them up in the morning and what keeps them going. And I would suggest that two of the things that encapsulate your career, your life, is talent, of course, which you have in abundance. But secondly, resilience, because a lot of people, you've, like everybody that's lived a life, you've had the blows. You've had that, as you described, the failures. And a lot of people would just roll over and go, right, okay, well, I'll go and get a different sort of career now then. You've gone, nope, no, I'm not taking this.
Yeah, I do. I think it's really important to, if you've met the dance gutter and been speaking to it, it's really important to pick yourself up, stand up again and say, right, I can do this. Maybe I need to change one little thing, you know, or have an opinion that your story can be told. I think that's important, you know, and that's why I became a director choreographer, because I wanted to tell stories. And that's obviously, you know, where the novel comes in as well, because I've had so much experience now as a director and a choreographer of telling stories. I just thought it'd be wonderful to write something myself that I could push out there to the world as well, so people do understand, you know, two other characters, and hopefully they'll fall in love with those characters like I did in real life with my flatmates. You know, obviously I spent 5 years there and I was always saving and searching for somewhere else, you know, something of my own, and I finally found a place in Camden Town that I could afford to buy, And I moved out of the house share, which was another hurdle, of course, because then you have the obligation of the mortgage, you know, which doesn't hit you until it hits you. And then, you know, and of course, all of this happened with Tamar McIntosh and me, you know, losing that particular part of my life and job. And I still had to pay that mortgage. There was no way out of it. So that was putting a lot of pressure on me to get out there and be successful, and not only just for money, obviously, but that's just the byproduct of it. But it's for the art, and that's what I love about it. So I'm glad I went down the route of following my passion, because I think that is important. I think you'll do a much better job if you're passionate about something rather than just doing it for the money or just doing it even hierarchical, you know, in if you want to be someone amazing. It depends what you want, but I think I always, as advice, would always say follow your heart and your dreams, because then you can truly learn to love yourself and everyone around you. And I think that in itself is important. I mean, people see me as a judge on Strictly, but they're only seeing 10 seconds of me critiquing a dance routine. And I think I'm sort of misconstrued in a way. I know that they call me Mr. Nasty, but that's not the truth about me at all, obviously, because I'm just literally wearing a judge's hat on something like Strictly Come Dancing. And I have 10 seconds to say what I think is wrong or right with it, so they can go away, learn something, and come back the following week a better dancer. You know, that's the whole point to it. I would hate to have been lied to, you know, with auditions. You know, you're always, when you're auditioning, you always want to know what you did wrong.
Yeah.
You know, why didn't I get that job? What is it about me that I need to improve? And it's always good to get feedback. And most actors and dancers absolutely love that feedback, because it makes you better. You can work on something. You can go home and think, okay, this is what I need to work on. You know, that happened to me once in a show called La Cage aux Folles. I went to an audition and I didn't get the job, and I couldn't understand why. Then I rang them up and they said, your arms are too wild. They're out of control. You need to control them. You know, we can't employ you. And so I went back to class, and I thought, right, I've been told this.
Yeah.
So I worked on my arms. I worked on all of that and tried to, you know, better myself and my dancing. And then out of the blue, I got a call from them literally 6 months later saying, we'd like you to be in the show. I couldn't believe it.
Amazing.
Yeah, it's amazing. So I didn't give up, I think, is the point. You know, I just worked on it. I thought, okay, I'm not going to let that, you know, push me down. I'm going to work on what I need to work on and get that job. And I eventually did. And it was one of the most wonderful periods of my life. And it taught me a valuable lesson that it's good to listen to people. You know, people give you critiques in order to help. They don't do it just to be nasty.
Well, and that's the great thing, is that the feedback that you give the contestants, and clearly the feedback that you've received in your career, has been stuff that people can work on and improve on. I mean, I once went for an audition, and when we asked why it didn't come through for me, I was told it's because my hair wasn't long enough. I can't do much about that.
You know? Well, you can get a wig, darling.
Well, we did offer. We did suggest a wig, you know, if it's really,
I know.
If that's really what it is, you know.
Yeah, but also they're looking for types. You know, you have to remember, I think, you know, particularly people that are performing out there, or any actor that comes in for a job, you never know what the director is looking for.
Mm.
And you shouldn't put that on yourself. You just need to go in, do the job that you're good at, and be the best that you can be. You know, and it could be down to type. And you're absolutely right. You might be too tall. You might be too short. You know, and or you might have the wrong color hair, or the wrong, you know, size shoulders or something, or too big a feet. You just don't know, do you? So I think it's best not to even think about that. If you're right for the role, the director will choose you, and it's that simple. You know?
Yes, absolutely, absolutely. Well, I mean, let's talk about Strictly Come Dancing. It's very nearly back, which is terrific. I think it's the tonic that the UK needs at the moment, something to sit down and just allow us to enjoy on a Saturday evening and a Sunday, of course. It's a tough old time, though, isn't it? We've had to have all sorts of rules and regs in place for the dancers and yourselves, actually, because of social distancing.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true. And I just have to commend the BBC for putting the show on. I think the nation needs it. I think it's one of those shows that provides hope, entertainment, and some normality in these weird times. You know, it's been quite upsetting for people, you know, and unnerving. And I think it's really important that people are subject to seeing it. I think, you know, they've all looked forward to it. And the BBC have just been incredible putting it on. Mm. And, you know, the rules around it are actually rather simple, bizarrely. You know, the dancers and celeb form an exclusive support bubble, which is something, of course, that is available to the public too. You know, and once they're in that bubble, they can then think of themselves and their pro-celeb partners and any members, of course, of their household as one single household. So, which means they're free, you know, to live freely, but can go to other jobs and all of that as long as they keep social distancing, you know. And, of course, there's the other rule that if someone gets COVID throughout it, then they would have to be taken from the competition to protect everyone else, which yes. is fair enough, you know. Yes. But I mean, I just, you know, all the government rules and regulations, as you know, and as we all know, change on a daily basis. So they've had to do a protocol really for absolutely every possible scenario, which cannot have been easy for the Bee, but, you know, hands up to them, they're doing an amazing job and they're going to produce one of the most spectacular series, I think, that we will see, because they've been pushed into creative corners, because they've been pushed into something different, you know. So I think the show will look very different and feel very different. And I think that makes it even more exciting.
Absolutely, absolutely. And I suspect it will also be the most watched of all. I mean, it's everybody watches it anyway, but you can just see even more people will want to be tuning into it, partly to see how and why it's different, but also because we just need a lift.
Yeah, and something that feels normal to the lead up to Christmas, something you can hang, you know, hang your heart on,
yes.
if you like,
yes.
to go, oh, thank God, a little bit of normality in the world. And, you know, a brilliant entertainment show on a Saturday night for all the family and people that are, you know, isolating, people that can't see that many people. Or if you, you know, at the moment it's 6, it could go down to 2. We don't know what's happening. It may be lifted entirely. But, you know, Strictly is going to be there for the people, and that's what it's all about, you know, entertaining the masses and actually giving families an opportunity to watch something together, because there isn't much of that on TV. In fact, I mean, you know, all you've got as choice of is Netflix, really, and you know, all the programs that people are trying to make at the moment, but a lot of it is reruns, isn't it? So it's yeah. quite difficult. But I mean, EastEnders obviously has come back. The BBC have managed to get, you know, some other TV programs on, which is fantastic. It's a bit sad for theatre at the moment, because there isn't much, well, there isn't any work in the theatre at the moment. So for those people, it's really difficult. But who knows, maybe those performers could cross over into film and television, because they're starting to become, you know, a thing that can be done with COVID. And it might be the way forward for people, you know, as well. That's and there will be, theatre will change, obviously, to suit. Theatre will not go away, no matter what. You know, people need to escapism, and they need entertainment, and they need to not think about their lives. And that's why people go to the theatre, you know, to sit there in the dark and maybe recognise themselves or learn something about themselves, you know, from the play or the show that they're seeing, you know. And it's an escapism, isn't it? And people need that. That's in right. in life.
Yeah, no, I think we've needed the arts now more than ever before. Craig, I'm mindful that we're very, very nearly out of time. I've got some random yeah. facts that I've found about you from the internet. Would you mind if I just sense check with them? Because some of them are quite bizarre, and I love it.
Okay.
I hope they're true. The first one, you were the face of KFC.
Yeah, Kentucky Nuggets. They were in Nuggets particularly, because that's when they first came out. Yeah, and I was dancing, and I had to drive up to a Kentucky Fried Chicken store in Australia in a VW Beetle convertible, and I had to go in and get nuggets for my girlfriend. And then as soon as I started eating them, I started dancing in the car park. So there you are.
That's
Kentucky
wonderful.
Nuggets. Yeah. Yeah, okay. I remember the jingle as well.
So, Face KFC, brilliant. You were the voice of McLean's toothpaste.
I am McLean showing. Yep, I was that too.
That's amazing. I love that. You have a waxwork in Blackpool.
Yeah, at Madame Tussauds.
Brilliant.
Bizarrely, Darcy Bottle and myself, darling. Darcy from Wenches of Ballerina and me from Strictly. Yeah, and you can, I'm interactive. You can actually, as soon as you touch my hand and start dancing with me, I start giving you criticism.
Oh, that's great. Presumably you've visited yourself a couple of times. I mean, you have to, right?
Yeah, my mum was up in Blackpool for the big launch for it. And the body came in and then the head came in on a platter afterwards. It was quite disconcerting because it's so real. I mean, it's unbelievable. Exact height, exact weight, exact everything. It's amazing. Wow. It was quite a long process, a 6 month process as well. And literally hours and hours of modeling at a time, you know, I was on a disc sort of spinning around at 5 centimeters. You know, every turn, it was weird. Christ. But amazing.
Yeah. Love the sound of that. Another one for you. Revel is your middle name, not a double-barreled surname.
Yeah, that's right. It's my grandfather's first name, who's now passed, but he was Revel Hallward. My father, who is now passed as well, was Philip Revel Hallward, and I was named after both of them, Craig Revel Hallward. But I changed it because there was another Craig Hallward at the time in Equity, and you couldn't have the same actors with the same names.
Yeah.
So I had to use Revel. But it's sort of the L and the H go better together anyway, because Craig Hallward, sort of the G and the H don't really work. My mother, I'm sure, was not thinking about that when she named me.
Well, it tracks brilliantly. I mean, when I have to tell my boys off, they get the full name as well. So, you know, maybe it'll carry through. You know, I do.
Yeah, it might do.
Do it gently and in a nice way. Don't get me wrong. A couple of other ones, which I know to be true, but I just think they're great, and I'd like to celebrate them. You choreographed the final scene of Paddington 2, which is just wonderful. I mean, it's just
Hugh Grant was absolutely amazing in it. I mean, he studied for 3 weeks. I was teaching him to tap because we wanted to do a tap number, big sort of outrageous sort of tap number in the prison. And I got all the old boys back, you know, from times, you know, when I was working in the West End. I was thinking, now who would be my age that would be sort of out of shape and looks like a thug, you know, or look like a murderer that could do a bit of pink tap dancing and put that together? You know, it was fantastic fun. I absolutely loved it. And Hugh was absolutely brilliant in it. After 3 weeks, he did his own tapping. He did all the beats, the rhythms. They didn't have to be dubbed, nothing. It was amazing. Really good.
And it's such a lovely feel-good moment as well. It's just a really...
It is.
Oh, it's an uplift. I love it. And I guess the last one really is that you were going to be having your one-man solo tour show going around all balls and glitter. And it's on pause, of course, because it has to be. But do you have any update on when it won't be on pause?
Yeah. It's going ahead on the 20th of February, and I've just literally finished rehearsing it. I've just had 3 weeks rehearsing it because it's the only time I could get the director, lighting designer, set designer, producers all together in one room to rehearse it. So we rehearsed that down in Southampton, and then that's all ready to go now. And I'm just doing some final tweaks for next year and praying that the 20th of February will be full on, and I'll be out there with it, and people are going to be, I think, quite surprised.
Good. Sounds wonderful.
Yeah, it's
brilliant.
Good. It's good fun.
It's non-stop for you, isn't it? It's a go, go, go.
Well, I think, you know, I've never been a lockdown type person, and if I am locked down, like I was, I decided to write the book and decided to get the one-man show together. I thought I can rehearse that. I can do that by myself. You know, there's a lot of things that you could do. I learned how to use the washing machine at home because that was all too complex for me. And plus, I was never available. Really, so I was literally coming into the house, you know, dumping washing and then just getting other clothes and taking them back out on the road again. So it's been a really nice time, you know, to learn how to use a sit-on mower, That was good. I broke the fan belt of that, or the belt of it. That started smoking, so the first time I used it.
you must have given it some beans then, Craig. I love that.
Oh, yeah, I'm well-versed with it now, darling. I'm well-versed with it, yeah. So it's been a learning experience for all of us, you know, and I've just been trying to make the most of the lockdown period, and not to waste the time, but to learn, you know, to read, to learn stuff about myself as well, you know, and improve my skills. I did some tap dancing as well. I've been brushing up on that, you know, for the one man show, which is sort of cool. Right. And yeah, it was fun just to go back to it. And especially after a double hip replacement, I thought, am I going to be able to do it anymore? You know, and the surprise and shock was, oh yeah, there's some beats still in there.
Amazing. Amazing. Yeah. I love it. Well, the one man show sounds brilliant. I'm going to have to come and see it. And as for the book, Dances and Dreams on Diamond Street, terrific. I really hope you write a sequel, because it's just lovely. I can't recommend it highly enough.
Thank you so much. That's very sweet of you.
Craig, thank you for your company. You've been an absolute joy to talk to. I've really, really enjoyed our chat. Thank you very much indeed.
Driven with Andy J.
Hey, welcome back to Driven Chat. Now, I've got one word to describe today's guest.
Gosh.
Handsome. Frustratingly handsome. Painfully handsome. Awkwardly handsome. If I could move the seats further apart, I would. He also happens to be lovely, a joy, and frighteningly intelligent. In fact, I need to find out something that he's not good at, because apart from the fact that it's a pleasure to be his mate, it's always awkward to sit near him and, you know, be associated with him because of handsome. I'm, of course, talking to David Gandy. How are you doing?
That's a nice intro. It might be the best intro I've ever had, I think. That was very nice. Makes me feel a lot better after lockdown.
I mean, come on, it follows you everywhere. Supermodel par excellence, known for, well, you're known for many things now, but it started off by being handsome.
I suppose, yeah, that's you know, the nature of the beast in the modelling industry, I suppose. But yeah, but I, you know, that's a strange thing is when I first came into the industry that you know, handsome, or which I don't honestly believe I'm, you know, handsome, classically handsome or anything like that, but wasn't wanted in the industry. You know, that was the weird thing.
We
don't want handsome. No, it was all about this.
If I'd known that back then, I could have been a model.
It was all about like the skinny boy androgynous kind of look, you know, which is actually after how many years, nearly 20 years, has now sort of come back. So, you know, you're looking at these very young, androgynous guys again, you know, modeling clothing. It never appealed to me.
Right.
You know, it wasn't inspiring to me.
A sort of aphid thin look.
Yeah, inspiring to me was, you know, when I came into the industry, was the Levi's guys. Mm. You know, that kind of old, you know.
The cowboys.
The cowboys, the old Hollywood. Yeah, exactly. Like, the, you know, that kind of thing. It was, and that came back, you know, slowly and slowly. But, so yeah, it wasn't always an asset in some ways. You're so well built, you're not right for us. Oh, thanks for that. I'm glad though.
I get that all the time. You wouldn't believe how often people say to me, Andy, you're just too buff. And it's like, and going into shops, you know, speaking on the phone, it follows me everywhere, David. So I feel your pain.
Honestly, the story that quite a few years ago, I got Most Stylish Man of the Year award for GQ, which was, you know, an honor, which was lovely. And it was the Hugo Boss Most Stylish Man of the Year award. So it's sponsored by Hugo Boss. They vote for it and you get the thing. 5 years before that, I was supposed to go and do a Hugo Boss show. I was brought into the show. I couldn't fit any of the clothing because I was apparently too big, too well built. So I was ejected basically from the whole thing. And they never actually, no one ever in the fashion industry, if something goes wrong, they never speak to you.
Oh, right.
You're just sort of left on
That's
your
friendly.
Own. You're sort of just lying around going, is everything okay? I mean, it's like no one's spoken to me for about, you know, 2 hours.
Yeah.
Yeah, everything's fine. And I go, should I not be getting dressed? Should I not be doing this? No one speaks to you. And then you get the agent call and they go, yeah, it's not going to work out. They've decided you're too big for this. And so I kind of went on a bit of a, you know, President got a bit stubborn about it and went, right, well, that's me, Hugo Boss, not wearing Hugo Boss ever.
Yeah.
And then they give me the Most Stylish Man of the Year award. And I was like, for not wearing Hugo Boss.
I mean,
that was quite an astonishing achievement.
That swings around about.
There's been some good stories actually through the years. We were having a chat the other day, and for Fashion Week, and we were going through a few of the stories, which were fun.
Well, look, we've got a lot to discuss, but I want to take you back to the beginning,
mm.
right? Because some people have probably forgotten your entry into the world, really, into modelling. Because, yeah, of course, we know you for the posters, we know you for the Speedos, we know you for the speed boats, we know you for the vitamins, and we know you for Marks and Spencers and many other things. However, people may have forgotten Richard and Judy.
Yes.
Which is where it all began.
I mean, now I see that video, I try and forget it. I'm very honest, and try and burn every copy that there is, and now it makes an appearance now and again. Yeah, but that's where I started. So I often go back to This Morning as well, because that's where it kind of started.
Yeah.
And they've kind of followed me, and they always go, well, do you want to come back and just chat, you know, what you're up to every couple of years? I'm like, yeah, of course I will.
It's because they want ownership. You know, and to be fair,
probably true,
you know, we discovered David Kent. Well, yeah, they kind of did.
There's probably a percentage to them of my going to them that I've never checked out. So yeah, it all started. I was at university, and it started from there. A housemaid of mine put me in for this competition, which turns out to be This Morning.
Now, is that true?
Yeah.
Like, was it really a housemaid, or were you like, oh, no, I'm having a good hair day. I'll just pop that into this competition.
Still waiting for a good hair day. Yeah, so that was basically, yeah, she put me in for it and didn't even really tell me. And they didn't reply to her. And then I got a phone call from Select, who is still my agent today, and said, you're down for this. And I literally put the phone down to them. So I'm really sorry. Don't know what you're talking about. And spoke to my housemate that evening. Said, very weird phone call from some guy at a modeling agency. And she went, oh, no. I put you in for a competition. You have to go. She then refused to come onto
this. She needs to carve this.
Now,
you're talking about Richard and Judy needing a cut. She needs to
cut. I was saying that, and then she refused to come on the TV program. I said, well, you have to come on as part of the whole thing. She went, I'm not going on television. So my mum had to come on, and I knew she wouldn't come on. So I went home, because I had to be up in London, came home from university, and literally the day before I said, by the way, this is a deal. I'm on television tomorrow. The camera crew are coming in 2 hours. And my mum went, no, I can't do that. I went, you have to, otherwise I've got no one. So my mum came and did it and pretended that she put me in for the competition.
Brilliant.
There we went from there.
That's really cute. The housemaid that entered you, obviously, you know, big favour there. That was a big deal. Was it a housemaid, or was there a little bit of a, was there some nighttime fun? I mean, because, you know, she was obviously drawn to you.
No, that was, we were very much mates and still keep in contact now and again.
It's a bit of a random way of asking if you were sleeping with the lady that submitted you for a modelling competition.
No,
I should have just gone straight down there.
If I was, I wouldn't admit it. But no,
because she hasn't aged as well as you. Actually, let's talk about that. I've mentioned age. You're 40 now.
Yeah.
Right now, for a model, I mean, 40 for normal people is a bit of a landmark moment.
Yeah.
You know, we were brought up, we're very similar in age, we were brought up with the whole slogan, life begins at 40, which actually plays in your mind thinking, oh, no, it doesn't, that's it, that's finished.
You know, over the hill now,
I'm supposed to be grown up, and I'm like, oh, you know, sounded a bit like a very random puppeteer, didn't I? Anyway, how's it affected you? Because, of course, you are now supposed to be an adult.
Yeah.
You know, you're supposed to have.
Yeah.
And you've got what I would describe, same as me, you've got the grown-up trappings, you've got you've got the baby, got the nice house, you've got some lovely cars. But what does it mean as a model? Is there some pressure now? Are you colleging it up? What are we doing here?
I've never really seen it. I came into the industry quite late at 20, you know, being 21, nearly 22. So I was already, I wouldn't say a back foot at all. I actually think it was good to come into the industry because I had a bit more experience. I had no experience whatsoever, but I had more experience than a 16, 17 year old who usually come into the industry. So I didn't sort of mind that. I had a little bit more confidence. I had, you know, probably an older head on my shoulders than a lot do. And the difference within, I suppose, myself and other models is that I totally saw this as almost like a business venture,
right?
Business point of view. The trappings of, the fame and the shoot and everything is wonderful. You know, the red carpets, it's very exciting. But at the end of the day, I was looking at this of, you know, always, where are we going in 5 years? How can we progress as a business?
Okay.
And it was really, you know, that's where I, everyone laughed at me because I used to say, well, the female supermodels, why do they earn so much money? How do they do this?
Yeah.
And I worked with a few and I spoke to them. And then gradually, over like the first 5 years of modeling, which I didn't do much at all. No one knew me and wasn't particularly very successful, and I was doing okay. But I just observed those 5 years of how the industry works. I didn't, you know, aspire to be in the fashion industry. And then, you know, so we sort of went from there. So it wasn't really until 2005, until I shot the Dolce & Gabbana campaign. The light blue the year, the following
Which has been colossal for you, hasn't it?
Yeah, still going. We're still shooting. Yeah, absolutely. We've shot four of those commercials now.
Do you reckon you'll still be doing them when you're 70?
Hopefully not. It's a bit of a flip now, just me getting older. If you did that, just me getting older. And it just takes a lot more work to get in shape now for those shoots and everything we have to do. So, so when that then the Light Blue came out, which was very exciting, I think some people may have sat on the laurels and just lived on that. That, to me, was another stepping stone to, right, where now can we leverage that from here? Well, where can we go with that? And we brought in teams and PRs, and the team gets bigger. To go from there, and everything was, which I saw the female supermodel was, they all had a name, as in everyone from outside the industry knew their name. Oh. So we had a Cindy Crawford and the Kate Mosses and the Naomi Campbells, and when you bring that on, it brings such a gravitas to a brand, you're above everyone else straight away. Oh. Where in the male modeling industry, no one had that. You may recognize people from certain, but you didn't know their names, you didn't know who they were. So it was all about brand building. And of course, that just built and built and built, and we just constantly sort of pushed the boundaries of where you go, with people laughing at me all along the way.
Yeah.
You know, I was, why do you want to work, you know, for 300 days a year for this amount when you can do 3 days for four times the amount? Right. That made no sense to me. Right. And it sounds quite big-headed to say that, but that's how the industry works.
Yeah.
And you know, people say, well, you'll never get that. That's the female models. That's you know. I said, well. What has anyone tried? Has anyone got this?
Yeah, yeah.
And we kind of went from there. And so hopefully, I lay down a foundation, a platform for then other guys to see where what is possible. And of course, the industry has changed now. It's digital, social media based. You know, it's a hard game now coming into the industry, because straight away brands, a bit like, you know, I brought so much, with a name and following and engagement, which, you know, with a brand, whatever I did, that is what they're looking for immediately in social media or digital kind of they bring.
A different way, isn't
so
it?
it's a tough game at the moment for younger generations coming in. And I mentor a few people, and people from a lot of guys approach me and ask me questions. And there's only so much I can really tell them, because it's changed so much. Not for the better, I have to say. I think it's always
because of social.
Not necessarily because of social, I think because of the marketing and advertising strategies that brands have concluded they should use.
Right.
And you had had these major brands, luxury brands, etc., who have so much money to spend on advertising and marketing and clever creative. Everything we've seen through the years of all the iconic books and the editorials and the campaigns of Avedon and Testino and Bruce Weber and all that, they're famous, they're iconic. Where are they now?
Right.
What do we have? I mean, there's an idea of that those adverts and those creatives have influenced us, not just shopping wise, but just influenced they're artists, the photographers and the art directors. And now it's given across to the brands are just not willing to pay for that talent and those photographers and everything that came with it.
Yeah.
So of course the creative is less, the engagement is less, but they're getting the engagement from the social media side, which of course is a lot cheaper.
Right.
And then they'll see sales go down a bit, and they say, we're not selling as much. So that we need to make some cuts. So the first thing they cut is advertising marketing.
Right.
And it goes in a spiral. And that's the way it goes. So I'm not blaming social media and influencers or anything like that. I'm blaming the brands, because they haven't done their research on it. You know, and they're still, Gucci are very good at still amazing creative, big names.
Yeah.
Who's, one brand's doing very well at the moment? Gucci. You know, there's other brands, Cartier the same.
Right.
They don't do much with social media or anything like that.
Yeah.
It's advertising. And hopefully you might see, especially during this time, we were chatting outside a little bit, of people now, there's an opportunity with so many people being at home and so many people engaged so much on television and social and everything, for brands to do something incredible. They need to spend some money and they need to bring back the incredible creatives. But I still believe in young talent as well. We're doing something at the moment. I think because then everyone is going to go, well, we're not using advertising. We're not using advertising as we did. We're not using photographers as we did. Then where are the young photographers going to do? Are they just all on social media? Is everyone just taking pictures themselves? So we're trying to now work on ideas of bringing very young talent into getting excited about photography. You know, just old school photography, not on your phones, a camera and everything else. So, and try and keep that going within the industry.
It will come back. It's not retro. You know,
no.
People will see the difference between what you take on your phone and what you take with a proper camera, with a proper lens, and they'll start to go, wow, actually,
and your
pops.
Those days, I mean, even when we saw the change from film photography to digital, and even there was a change, because before, you know, a client or a brand couldn't see what a photographer and what an art director, the best in the world, could see. The great photographer will go, click, got it.
Yeah.
Got that one.
Yeah.
Art director, got it. Client could sit there and go, sure, you got it. Okay, yeah, I got it. And you would end up with, you know, these rolls of films which no one could see at the end of the day, but they would go off to be processed, and they would capture a moment. They were never, you know, okay, they're perfect. But if you looked at them from a digital point of view, because we all correct our, you know, creatives now and make little changes, you couldn't. That was the image you got. So you might have got a bit of lens flare, you might have got a bit of movement.
Yeah.
That was the image. It was capturing a moment of that time. And then when digital came in, you had a table or monitors with all the clients, with all the brand, and they used to stand there and go, ooh, that shirt's not quite. And photographer went, right, okay, well, let's change that.
Which is a shame, isn't
and
it?
Sat there.
It and takes then the craft out of it.
You ended up with this perfect picture, which was imperfect, you know, but what, you know, it wasn't that creative element completely been taken out. So, and that was just, and then instead of shooting, say, 5 pictures a day, it was 20 pictures a day, because you could see it instantly and it went through. And it just felt like it feels like a bit of a machine.
Right.
And that's what it is at the moment.
Completely
really
lost its spontaneity.
Absolutely. So, we're always trying to, you know, if there's a shoot, I said, that's not what we're doing, but we're bringing in teams. And I've done a lot of creative myself now. And I have something that I learned from working with some of the best photographers, and Mario and all those different people, is often the same team. Because when you came, you could trust everyone. Everyone was enthusiastic for that job. No one was like, well, 5 o'clock, we're all going to go home.
Yeah.
It was, if the shot didn't get done, we were going to work till 9, 10 o'clock at night. But it was always fun. There was a nice atmosphere. And that's hopefully the same as the teams I bring in. So when I work with brands, they say, well, write about the creative, and you know, that's the easy part.
Yes,
that's simple. We'll work that one out.
I'm exactly the same as you. With everything we do with Driven, the things we do and the things we create are because of the people that are in our Driven family. You know, last few months, I've been exposed to a lot of celebrities, and because of lockdown and whatnot, we're either meeting face to face in the truck because we go to their homes, or I'm sent their mobile numbers, not their person's mobile number or their whatever. I'm sent their mobile number. And what has been really revealing for me is I will always text afterwards if I've got them up, thanks ever so much.
Yeah.
There are some who are straight back replying, loved it, you know, whatever they say, whether it's nice or not, but they immediate reply. And sometimes they even follow a dialogue. And when the show's up, they kind of, oh, I've just been listening. And oh, you know, I love that you kept that bit in, or whatever it might be. The ones that always throw me are the ones that you'll have a really great chat with. You know, you feel you've both shared something special. You send a thank you note, never replied. And there's a few people, and I'm just like, wow.
Yeah.
I thought we'd really connected. And you don't even say, you know, not even an emoji thumb would do. You know? It's all you need. I'm not trying to be your mate. You can block my number if you want afterwards, but just acknowledge it. How hard is that?
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. I think it's a bit of, we're in a phase. And I do a lot for mental health and men's mental health. It's such a, and what you learn from there is actually we're so connected, but actually we are the most disconnected generation ever. That actually, yes, there are so many processes we can connect together. Actually, this process of actually talking, we don't actually really talk anymore.
Yeah.
It is through a text message, through a WhatsApp, or a, you know, emoji or something else. And I just think so many, I sometimes think that there are so, especially during lockdown, I noticed, that because no one was communicating, that I was missing emails or a message, and people came back to me, can you get back to me about that? And I said, when did you send it?
Yeah.
Because everything was just electronic.
Yeah.
I said, I'm so sorry, but everyone's communicating with WhatsApp now. So I'm missing certain things where you go, I'll do that one later, and you forget about it.
Yeah.
So it is, I do think, I mean, I'm quite old fashioned. I love a phone call.
Mm.
You know, people are shocked. You know, they write me an email, and I go, I'll give them a call. Hi, and they go, oh God, why are you calling me? And I'm like, because we would be doing this for the next 4 hours on email.
Yeah.
Let's get it done in the next 5 minutes, because I haven't really got time to deal with this, like, you know, to go on all day. And it often gets things done. I quite enjoy that.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Well, I am enjoying actually joking about that. We were talking about, you know, working out and you know, how much hard it is. I haven't worked out for 4 months.
I mean, it shows, David. I've been when you walked honestly, out, I was like, "Whoa, hang on a second."
It honestly does.
Bladder alarm coming along.
Yeah, particularly we were, as I said, we were up in Yorkshire for the whole of lockdown for about 3 months. We didn't work out, and then we went on holiday, and I still didn't work out. I was doing physical work. I was working on the land and the garden, but not the same. I cannot move today from pain. I'm on ibuprofen because I've been back to the gym for 2 days. I cannot move. I mean, before lockdown,
it's 40, David. That's the problem.
Don't say
that's
that.
That's what it
because
is.
Because I'm a little bit worried.
So you'll start to get patella tendonitis in your knees next.
I walk out the gym with a twinge, and then I've got like a dodgy eye, like walking down. I'm not even sure what that is.
So I'm thinking about the hunchback look.
Is that in?
Yeah, it's going to happen.
And you know, it just shows like how hard when people work, it does take a long time to see success and to see results. But within 3 months, I mean, I was pushing, not too, like, too much weightlifting here, but I was pushing about 45 kilograms a side on my chest.
It's about what I do. Yeah.
And
I'm a little higher than that, actually.
You should
push yourself a bit more.
And then the other day I thought, I'll warm up, by the way, this was my warm up for 20 a side. Got to like rep 6, and I was like, on the first set, and I was like, 20 a side.
I just popped a hemorrhoid.
Yeah. I just thought, this is ridiculous. So I thought it must be the heat, must be something else. So I put another 5, and so I was on 25, so, which is really nothing. Had a proper fail, dropped it on my chest in the gym, had to roll it down, I think, onto the thing. My arms were like jelly. And I persevered and went back last night to do another muscle group, and I woke up this
15.
Morning. Yes, that's just embarrassing. But it shows actually how quickly your body loses. You know, that sort of unity of working out all the time and sort of that muscle kind of thing. So
yeah, it's unnerving.
It was absolutely mad. So yeah, I'm back to scratch, it seems, now working at the gym, which is a bit disappointing.
Something tells me you'll be all right. Just
you
just
never know.
The looks of things.
Not at 40, this could be it. Call me next time, we're like, I'm done.
You'll be like, yeah, we'll do it on the phone, yeah?
I can't pick the phone up.
There'll be a phone interview, and I'll send you some photos.
Send me a WhatsApp. I can't get my phone up to my
it's
head at the
an
moment.
Archive collection interview. Let's talk about my greatest hits. You say, I know we're kind of coming out of time now, but you mentioned you do a lot for men's mental health, which is something that, you know, is becoming a lot more prominent, which is great. But if I can ask kind of humbly, why is that? What has got you involved in men's mental health? Is it because you've had some sort of circumstances yourself, or just because you're aware of?
Compared to lots of people, the severity of the problem, I've had nothing. Hmm. But I call them little dark periods, and they're things that you cannot explain to anyone. Very, very strange, and you just go into a bit of a dark hole, and I always know you'll snap out of it.
Yeah.
You don't know why. Wake up one day and you're snapped out. But before that, it's a bit of a dark time. I've been around people in past relationships and girls who suffered quite badly from it and bipolar. So I've seen the other side to it. And just in the world that we are at the moment, again, we're going back to social media and no one talking, no one connecting properly. It's a major issue. It's the biggest killer of men under 45, which is male suicide.
Yeah.
And I just think, I'm not sure if it was, we don't talk about, we've started something called the Whole Man Academy, which is a company we've started, which we say it's for men to do life better.
Okay.
And really it's just about everyone talking, everyone chatting. I've done talks and we've done podcasts of just people hearing how have overcome certain problems, sort of ideas like that. Not just to let everyone know that it doesn't matter how much money you earn, doesn't matter about fame or success or anything, it does not matter. You can go into these periods and no one really, really knows about it. And men are useless at talking.
Yeah.
Women have this advantage in the point that, and this is hopefully not being stereotypical between the two sexes, but women talk, as in, they're friends. Men go down the pub and take the piss out of each other.
Yeah.
And that's something I think we are opening up more and we need to. But Whole Man Academy and other things we're doing is just a chance to have a chat and realize you're not on your own and just have an opportunity. If you feel like you've acknowledged something in the podcast or in the chat, just have a chat to someone about it, and we can help, or you may just feel better listening to other people.
Do you know what? To hear someone like you, who from the external has got it made. You know, so you know, like if I was having a dark day, as you describe it, and I was you, the flippant part of me would be like, how do I get out of this? I know, I'll look in the mirror. Because you're David Gandy. And you look back at yourself and you're, oh, no, we're still good. We're all right. That handsome comes back.
Yeah.
But it's not like that. And that's the point. Is it doesn't matter who you are and what you've got in your life and how much back end is happening in your world.
Yeah.
You are still allowed and are prone to have
funk
days.
The thing is, the thing is, Randy, if we all, I mean, we do this, not that we could talk about this for hours, I've got a children's charity as well, where we all pigeonhole and stereotype each other. Mm. You're this or this. Mm. You can do mass chemistry, but you're brilliant, you're very clever. If you can't, you're not going to go anywhere. Yeah. We do this through schooling, we do it through education, and we do that, you know, throughout everything. So you're an introvert or extrovert. Well, maybe you're not. I'm quite an introvert. But actually, there's an extrovert that loves being on set, that loves playing a character, that loves being around everyone, which is opposite to how I am in real life, which is a complete loner. And I always have been. Mm. To be alone with the dog and to go for 4 hours of walking is my ideal. Mm. I just seem, you know, and I've now got this little midget person called Matilda that's with me, usually sitting on my shoulders, which is, you know, which is great as well. You know, that's amazing. But you're pigeonholed into one of these two categories. And it just doesn't exist anymore. You know, it's like there are so many different elements to everyone. And when everyone looks at something with someone in the public eye and they look at the red carpets and the fame and the cars and all this and the crowds and the people coming up to you and think, God, that must be wonderful. Yeah. And a lot of the time it is. But you could be one of two people. My other half, Steph, when she's around people, she gets encouragement from it. She loves being around other people. She gets such an energy from it. If I'm in that situation, I get drained after a while,
really?
And I just have to get out.
Yeah.
So yes, it is nice for a while, but then it sort of backfires a little bit. Where in the end, you demonstrate you just would need to get out. You know, you can't get away from it because it's very draining. So it's automatically thought that this is brilliant. And sometimes, and you know, I'm not saying it's not. It's just, you know, you can be very different from other people. But again, it's, you know, this is good, that's bad. Well, sometimes it's not. You have to meet in the middle somewhere. And it's a very difficult thing for people who've never suffered to understand it. Mm. You know, that's the biggest thing to understand. I can't understand the extremities of mental health because I've never gone through them.
No.
But I can understand probably that if I had those darker times and they were 10 times worse than that and you weren't going to snap out, you know, I know I'm going to snap out of it. If I didn't, where's the ending from there? You know, that's how I kind of picture it. So, yes, it's something we all need to have a chat about.
Yeah,
which is fine, but that's it.
No, I'm glad you're doing it. It's one of the things that we've had as a recurring theme on Driven, and it's come up with so many people. Never with me going, oh, tell me about your mental health, but people bring it up. You know, it's something that Katie Mallower, you know, she told me about how she was hospitalised with a nervous breakdown because of the pressure of life.
Yeah.
You know, and externally we look at all these people and we're like, wow, 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 and then you realise, do you know what?
Mm.
Everyone's got their own truth, and more often than not, everyone's got their own challenges.
Mm.
And whilst your challenge to me might seem like, oh, that's easy. To you, it's a huge challenge, you know, and to the next person. So we can't judge other people.
Yep.
We just need to live our own lives. And if we need help, pick up the phone.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, very, very true. And it's often the people that you think are fine that are sometimes suffering. It's the quieter ones that you look at and think, that's absolutely fine. You're competent, you're confident, and everything else. They're actually hiding. I mean, I still say, if I turn up for a red carpet, for anything, for GQ Awards, there's a moment every time I get in that car that if someone said, do you want the car? Do you want to get out? I'll be like, nope. I'm still pushing myself to this day, and I've done so many of them. But it's you get out and the cameras and the people, and you just, once you're in it, then you're fine. But it's that point before, and it's the amount of people you speak to go, oh, we're exactly the same.
Really?
Plus 10. But you know, you're perceived as, you should love that straight away. It should. And there are some people that, you know, do love that, and that's absolutely fine. But again, we're going back on to everyone is different, and people has to accept that there are differences. And differences scares people in life. That's the thing.
David, I mean, once again, it's always such a pleasure talking to you. You've
Thank
proven
you, sir.
To me again, rather frustratingly, you're much more than handsome. You know,
that's very kind.
Deep thinking, insightful.
Apparently can't push 25 kilograms. But
I mean, turns out you're a bit of a weakling, but that's okay.
I'll take it.
Now I've found your weakness. I'm going to bench 26 in front of you and beat that. You can't. David, thank you very much for your company.
Pleasure. Thank you, sir.
Pleasure.
Driven with Andy J.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.